It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about a tough choice some Wisconsin farmers are making as they face retirement or tough economic times, whether to rent or sell their farms. First, it's time for a weekly check-in on the top stories in national politics. Congress faces a deadline at the end of the month to fund the government. A bill nearing a vote in the House would allow more legal immigrants convicted of violent crimes to be deported. And journalist Bob Woodward's new book paints a picture of a dysfunctional administration with many in the White House losing faith in the president. Our question for you this week, do you plan to read Woodward's new book, Fear Trump in the White House? Why or why not? Do you think you're likely to trust the book's account of a chaotic administration, or do you have questions, as many members of the Trump administration do, about its accuracy? Do books like this change your opinion? Do you think they change public opinion on the president? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
Well, a lot going on in September in Congress, it looks like, and hanging over the to-do list is the September 30th deadline to fund the government. Here we are again, a government shutdown, I guess, once again, the alternative. How are members of Congress working to avoid that?
Yeah, well, it's that time of the year again. They are facing down a deadline, and it's really coming up quick. This was an abbreviated week already because of the Jewish holiday of Rosh Hashanah. Next week, the House is out. And so that leaves basically one legislative week to fund the entirety of the government. And this year, they're trying to do it a little bit differently. They're trying to go back to regular order, more or less, and do packages of, you know, three bills at a time, three spending bills at a time, dealing with different elements of the federal government, instead of putting on President Trump's desk one big omnibus spending legislation that he has said that he doesn't want to sign anything like that again. So it kind of drags out the process, makes it more slow going, and I'm just not sure that there's enough time, frankly, for them to get it done.
So these are, and I think you introduced me to this phrase last time you were on, Dan, these are mini-bus pieces of legislation they're being called.
That's right. So omnibus would be the entire thing, and mini-bus is the shorthand for, you know, packages of three bills or so. They've only got one done so far, and there's 12 bills to do. So they have one done that handles the military construction and veterans affairs, energy and water, like the Department of Energy and things like that, and Congress's own spending, the legislative branch spending. But they're going to conference now. The House and the Senate are going to start talking about working out their differences on two other minibuses. But it's just, like I said, time is running really short, and there are some really, really controversial issues, particularly that have to do with abortion and health care. They paired together the bill dealing with health spending with the Defense Department bill, kind of hoping that they can, that members would be more willing to iron out their differences on a bill dealing with, you know, health care. It's been such a divisive issue on the Hill if they also know that they're voting to fund the Defense Department. So we'll see how that goes. But as it stands right now, House Republicans are, you know, trying to do things like cut funding to Planned Parenthood. They want to include language in the bill to allow doctors to sue if they're forced to perform abortions, a ban on research using fetal tissue, and another measure allowing faith-based adoption agencies to decline to place children with gay couples. So you can see, you know, social issues really rearing their head here, and it's just not clear that they're going to be able to work out these very controversial differences before the deadline.
Now it's election season. Everybody in the House is up for re-election. A third of the Senate. Does this make members of Congress kind of timid? Am I going to vote on something that's going to be an attack ad against me tomorrow? Congressperson so and so voted for or against this vital thing.
Well, more than timid, let me give you an example. Representative Ron DeSantis, who's running for governor in Florida, resigned the other day. And the kind of joke around Capitol Hill is that he'd rather resign than have to vote on another omnibus because he's running for re-election. He's running for election in the governor's race in Florida. I mean, voting for some of these things, it's like a black mark on your record when in the eyes of conservatives. It's just basically a gigantic bill, all aspects of the federal government funded in it, and there's just going to be some things that you don't like in there, one way or the other. So it just opens you up to political attack and saying, oh, you voted to fund this thing or that thing or not fund this thing or that thing. And so members often, a lot of members, particularly House Republicans, try to avoid it and vote against these things.
Hey, speaking of huge pieces of legislation, Dan, the Farm Bill is up there. There's a deadline coming up for reauthorization of that. A lot in that bill that affects us here in Wisconsin, of course. Where are we on that?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. They're working in conference. They have been since last month. But it's been pretty tight-lipped, so we don't know exactly what the goings-on are day to day. We do know that the biggest hurdle remains the work requirements that House Republicans have tried to impose on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also known as food stamps. They want to require most adults who are in the program, including some parents who have children under the age of six and older workers up to the age of 60, to prove every month that they worked or participated in a work program for at least 20 hours a week or qualified for an exemption. And that is just a non-starter for Democrats. But even Senate Republicans do not want to do that. I think for the most part, even if they are ideologically simpatico with House Republicans here, they don't want to open up that can of worms knowing that it could jeopardize farm subsidies, especially when farmers, as you all know out in Wisconsin, are hurting enough.
Talking to Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal, looking at some of the big stories in national politics right now. Want to turn to this Bob Woodward book, Fear, Trump in the White House. And I sold 750,000 copies on day one. It's been news since before it came out. Want to invite listeners, are you going to buy and or read this book? Let us know why or why not at 800-642-1234. Dan, at least for Washington reporters, this book is getting a lot of attention. Do you think that a lot of people in the political world there in D.C. are looking at this thing, wondering what's going to come out, what's true, what's not true?
I mean, absolutely. And it's not just political reporters. I think Barnes & Noble said the other day that this is the fastest-selling book since Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman, which was, you know, obviously a huge literary event. So this is you know, in and of itself a momentous book. Woodward has written a book about every president since Nixon. You know, it's nine presidents. And whenever he talks and whenever he writes, more specifically, people listen. People read it. He has great sources. He has, he's one of the most respected, if not the most respected, newspaper reporter in the country. And I think everybody is just waiting for, you know, the next revelation to come out.
What are some of the things that have caught your eye so far and what's been released from the book in advance?
Well, there's some pretty troubling stories about relating to foreign policy. For instance, a month after Trump became president, he wanted to plan a preemptive strike on North Korea. He ordered Defense Secretary James Mattis to assassinate Bashar Assad, the president of Syria. And the fact is, maybe the most troubling thing about it, and something that a lot of critics have honed in on, is that we seem to be in a sort of constitutional crisis where, if what is in this book is to be believed, the president's own aides do not think that he is able to lead the country. They don't think that he's smart, frankly. They don't think that he's sane, according to the book. And they often just don't listen to him. Like, of course, Jim Mattis, when he was told to assassinate Assad, essentially just didn't. Another one is an economic advisor, Gary Cohn, basically taking pieces of paper that Trump was supposed to sign related to trade off of his desk because he thought it was bad policy and it would precipitate a trade war, and Trump not noticing. So, you know, it's very troubling stuff, and basically you can just add it to the pile of other troubling reports coming out of the White House.
Now, some cabinet members and others in the White House have denied saying what they're quoted as saying. President Trump responded in a tweet saying, quote, "The Woodward book is a scam. I don't talk the way I'm quoted. If I did, I would not have been elected president. These quotes are made up." Woodward responded to some of those criticisms on the Today Show this week. Here's a listen.
The people I talked to, I insisted be very specific about the incidents, exactly what happened. And as I've said, and I think this is important, the building blocks of journalism are specific events what happened on this day, who said what, and this is a volume of Trump talking and acting and deciding.
Now, we had a previous book, Michael Wolff's Fire and Fury. Omarosa Manigault Newman had her book out after her time in the White House. Do you think a Bob Woodward book carries more weight?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, in both of those cases, there were, you know, some credibility questions raised. With Bob Woodward, he is essentially unimpeachable. I mean, he has been doing this for a long time with a lot of people. You know, he doesn't need to make up quotes to make money. He's got plenty, frankly. And he's known to be meticulous, and he keeps records, he keeps recordings, he has a paper trail for everything that he puts in the book. So when he writes something, he's so well regarded that you can pretty much take it to the bank.
Talking to Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal about some of the week's top news in politics. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234 on the Bob Woodward book. Are you planning to read the book? Have you bought it yet or got it on hold at the library yet? Have you seen details from the book that have you worried, or are you skeptical about the book? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. We asked you if you're planning on reading the book, what you thought about the Bob Woodward book. Kevin in Richland Center weighed in. Kevin says Woodward knows from his work on Watergate what free speech is all about. He understands that not even the president can avoid the watchful eye of the press. Kevin says, glad he's continuing to search for the truth. On a related, maybe related note, Dan, there have been a bunch of polls out over the last week or so showing the president's poll numbers slipping, not a huge amount, but into the sub-40 approval category. Democratic-Republican generic ballots swinging more in favor of Democrats. From what you've seen, is this a worrisome moment for Republicans?
Yeah, Republicans are incredibly worried. In the House, the scoop has been for the last couple of months already that they are Republicans in serious danger of losing their majority in the House. But now, with the president's numbers slipping, there's some talk that even the Senate could go, which would really be momentous. I mean, Democrats are defending way more seats in the Senate this year than Republicans are. So if Republicans were able to win, it would mean tough races in Florida, maybe even Texas, being taken by Democrats. So they are trying to get out there on the campaign trail. The House is House Republicans are, like I said, not spending a lot of time here this month. So that means that their candidates can get out there and campaign. In the Senate, it's actually going to be the opposite. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said he's going to try to keep the Senate in session through October because part of the reason is, I guess, a political strategy that if he keeps them here, more Democrats who are facing reelection are going to be here in D.C. rather than back home campaigning.
Let's bring on a caller. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I haven't read the book yet, but I've been listening to Bob Woodward interviews on all kinds of television shows. Especially Stephen Colbert and Rachel Maddow, and his methodology is meticulous. And let's face it, there's no Trump behavior that I've heard of in the book that sounds out of the ordinary Trump behavior. Just absolutely third, fourth grade level and pretty ignorant of what's going on around him.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Dan, is it possible that, okay, this book is going to confirm what people who already don't like Donald Trump already thought about him, and if people do support the president, they'll be able to dismiss it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that's already been happening. You look at Trump's concerted attacks on media, vaunted media institutions like the New York Times, the Washington Post. He has made it a centerpiece of his presidency to discredit media institutions and frankly the media as a whole. So for him to go after Woodward, it's not even a surprise. But he may have met his match here. Your caller just said, Woodward has a great reputation. Now, are people who already support Trump and are already primed to think that everything that any media person says about Trump that's negative is a lie going to believe Woodward? Probably not. But you know, that's not really Woodward's intent. He can't force anyone to believe him. He is trying to tell a story and tell the truth, and that's the best that he can do. If people believe it, they're going to believe it.
Thanks for that call. Dan, I want to move on to another issue now that you've been writing about. A bill nearing a vote in the House would allow more legal immigrants convicted of violent crimes to be deported. Can you give us some background on why we're here?
Yeah, actually, they did vote on this last week.
Oh, they did vote. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was a very interesting bill, and I was actually surprised it didn't get more press. This stems from an April Supreme Court ruling that found that the federal definition of a quote crime of violence is unconstitutionally vague. There was a gentleman who was a legal immigrant from the Philippines who was convicted twice of burglary, and the federal government tried to initiate deportation proceedings against him. This went all the way again to the Supreme Court, and they basically said that the immigration law that allows the federal government to deport non-citizens for these so-called crimes of violence didn't give a good enough definition of what is a crime of violence. Is burglary a crime of violence? Is this? Is that? So after that happened, the president tweeted that the Congress should do something about it to change the definitions, and here Congress did. They basically voted to, you know, restore the federal government's ability to deport immigrants for all kinds of violent criminal offenses. Now, the problem is that Democrats thought that the process was bad. There were no hearings on this bill, no witnesses, and essentially you're making a major change to criminal law without fully considering the implications. One of the, you know, for instance, if I'll dig into this, what they did is they took the law and said, here are crimes of violence, burglary, murder, sexual assault, this and that, and they listed all these different ones. A lot of them, obviously, murder is, of course, a violent crime, but some of them were, Democrats thought, a little dubious. For instance, fleeing. You know, they thought it might give a little too much leeway to the police to charge somebody with, you know, a violent crime if they are simply evading arrest, or maybe they're looking for a place to park but going too fast while being chased by a patrolman or something like that. So just they really wanted to kind of flush out these potential issues, and they really felt that it didn't get a fair hearing.
Right. Everybody, it seems like, generally agreed, yeah, this law could use some clarification. Most of these crimes would certainly fit the bill, but they're worried that it there could be some unintended consequences. That was the objection?
Absolutely. And you know, just the speed with which it happened, they don't think that members who were voting on this bill fully understood what it was and what it did. Again, this wasn't just a change to immigration law. This was a change to federal statute, the criminal statute that governs all crimes. So if you do that, do you open up, you know, anybody to increased prosecution for crimes that, you know, whether or not they're violent might actually be in question? You know, they wanted to at least talk about it, and this comes, you know, especially in an era when people are trying to, or at least talking about, and a little bit more receptive to criminal justice reform with the aim of, you know, reducing our prison population. So they were wondering, you know, is this going to actually be a step in the wrong direction?
Talking to Dan Neuhauser from the National Journal, looking at some big stories in national politics. Former President Obama returned to the campaign trail last weekend in a speech where he criticized President Trump by name for the first time, apparently, also with a critique for Republican lawmakers. Here's a listen.
Republicans who know better in Congress, and they're there, they're quoted saying, yeah, we know this is kind of crazy, are still bending over backwards to shield this behavior from scrutiny or accountability or consequence, seem utterly unwilling to find the backbone to safeguard the institutions that make our democracy work.
Obama admits he's breaking the tradition for ex-presidents to criticize the sitting president. Vice President Pence criticized him for that reason. Do we know why he's back in and now?
Well, I think it's pretty clear he believes that we're in a pivotal moment in American history. He thinks the Trump administration is not just a regular administration that he could have policy differences with, but that it's actually detrimental to the country. So he's going out there and he's taking on Trump. And you know, the significance of this really can't be understated. Can't be overstated. He remains the single biggest figure for Democrats in the absence of any other really major political national figures for the party. Hillary Clinton lost. She's doing her part, but she doesn't have the credibility of a former president. And there hasn't really been somebody to step up and fill the void of a Democratic president, the gravitas that brings. So him going out there for candidates and to counter Trump head on by name, that's really a big deal.
Is he seen as a difference maker? I think he's been in California, among other places. Is he seen as a difference maker in those districts that people see as being vulnerable to switching from Republican to Democrat? We keep hearing about your suburban districts, for example.
Yeah, it really depends on the district. I mean, if he's in California, I think that will be helpful. If he goes to, say, eastern Kentucky, I'm not so sure. Some of those districts, you're going to have to rely on Republicans who, maybe voted for Trump last time, maybe sat out on the election, to be so horrified by what's going on that they're going to want to vote for you. And it's not clear that Obama is going to move the needle for some of those people. Now, where he could be extremely helpful is in riling up the base. I mean, he remains is still incredibly popular with the Democratic base. And if you're trying to get out the vote and increase, your base voting, like he's doing, and actually the former First Lady Michelle Obama is doing, the former president and his wife are going to make a difference there.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Anytime.
Dan Neuhauser is a staff correspondent for the National Journal. He joined us to recap some of the week's biggest stories in politics, as we do every Wednesday here on Central Time. Farmers in Wisconsin are facing tough economic conditions. There's the issue of low commodity prices and an added hit from tariffs in recent international trade disputes. When farmers leave the business, they have a big decision to make whether to rent out their farmland or sell land that might have been in their family for generations. Arlen Brandstrom is Faculty Associate Emeritus for the UW Center for Dairy Profitability. He's also treasurer of the Wisconsin chapter of the American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers. Arlen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Well, before we get to that rent or sell decision, we are seeing a lot of farmers in Wisconsin, right, deciding to get out of the farming business.
We certainly are. It's difficult to get exact numbers, but especially in the dairy industry, we're seeing a large decrease in the number of smaller dairy farms for each family unit that decides to bail out of the dairy industry. Of course, we're seeing a couple other larger farms expanding, but overall, I would say we are, especially with these difficult financial times for crop producers as well as the dairy industry, we're seeing more people deciding to maybe hang up the farming profession altogether.
Now, in this rent or sell decision, one important background factor is the price, the value of farmland. What have we seen happen with that in Wisconsin over the last, say, decade or so?
Well, I'm basing my answer based on the transfer return information that comes from our Department of Revenue. And if we look at that over the last decade, farmland values have remained very strong, actually even stronger than I would have guessed based on the profitability of the enterprise or the rate of return that you can expect on farmland. Last year, the statewide average was about $4,000 an acre for agricultural land, or at least land that was coded as being in agricultural use when it was sold. Now, some of that might have been land that was going to be converted into development or some other use. Some of it might have been coded as agricultural land, but probably didn't grow a crop this year. But overall, the average was about $4,000 an acre.
So for a lot of farmers, it's possible that their land is their most valuable asset on hand.
By far and away, it is the most valuable asset. In fact, in my work working with real estate appraisers throughout the country, or throughout the state particularly, I've heard them say a number of times that the contributory value of the buildings in most cases is not very significant. It's the value of the farm is in the land.
Talking to Arlen Brandstrom about the decision a lot of farmers are facing in Wisconsin. If they're getting out of the business, do they outright sell their farmland or do they rent some or all of it out? And let's get into that decision, Arlen. What kind of factors would farmers be weighing if they're saying, I want to sell versus I want to rent it out?
Well, it's a complicated decision and something that probably shouldn't be made haphazardly. A lot of producers, when they retire, they could continue to sell the animals and just continue to crop the land themselves, or they could maybe find a neighbor that would be willing to rent the property either on a crop share basis or a cash rent basis or even something we call a flex basis, which is basically a contract that has additional incentives based on how the commodity markets or the growing season goes. So there's a lot of issues to walk through. One of the things I think people need to consider also is some of the impacts that the decision to rent versus to continue to farm might have would be their impacts on Social Security retirement benefits as a farmer.
Now, for renting, it seems like if the farmer makes the decision to rent out some of their cropland for someone else to farm, am I right? There's demand out there. If they want to rent it, there's a good chance there's somebody who wants that land to farm.
Absolutely. There's never a shortage of people looking to add additional acreage to their operations. That's one of the reasons why I think renting is so popular. It's the farmers who are renting essentially have a big investment in machinery, and they'd like to spread that investment over as many tillable acres as they can. I think one of the, in order for a rental arrangement to be successful, you have to have a contract that works well for both the sellers or the renters, as well as the tenants, the person who's going to be operating the farm. And so as an owner looking for a renter, I think it's important that you need to be knowledgeable and know what the competitive rates are for farmland in your area. You need to know something, I think, about who you're dealing with in terms of potential tenants. Are they reliable? Have they rented land with other people in the area before? Are they good communicators? Are they willing to share with you what they've been able to do in terms of yields on other crops they've grown in the past? Are they familiar with some of the lease law in Wisconsin and that kind of thing? And are they proactive? Are they willing to talk to you if they have a problem? I think all those things, if those are positive, I think you've got possibly a good tenant there to work with.
Now, Arlen, it does sound complicated. I imagine for a lot of farmers, it's the first time they're considering doing something like this. And this is a hugely important decision for their personal finances in the short and long run. Are there resources out there for that farmer to help them figure out if what a good rental deal is for them?
There are. The University of Wisconsin Extension, I think, in most county offices would have information budgets and that kind of thing that would help you as a tenant or as an operator to determine what's a realistic expectation for your particular farm in terms of its yield potential. And I would encourage people to, if they're thinking about renting, to get in touch with their county extension agents and think about seeing if there's some help that can be provided at that level. Another resource, as I said, I'm secretary treasurer for a statewide farm appraisal organization, and that American Society of Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers Group has resources as well that could help people determine what's a realistic value for their property and maybe provide some additional information about, if they're considering selling, what's a reasonable way to approach the sales decision.
Yeah, if they decide, or I guess what are the advantages of going for selling off that farmland versus entering into a rental agreement?
Well, one obvious advantage would be that if they were to sell the property, this may enable them to diversify some of their assets into other types of resources. They might want to put some of that money in CDs or in stocks or other residential real estate, rental property, and so forth, to diversify a little bit. one thing I think that a lot of farmers are reluctant to do is to diversify, because they've owned this farm, or the farm's been in the family for a long time, and they're very familiar with what its capabilities are if they're operating it themselves. I think it's important to kind of take a longer-term perspective and look at what your opportunity costs for other investment types would be as well.
I want to talk about the emotional side for a moment, apart from just the finances. I've definitely talked to a lot of farmers in Wisconsin who are the third or fourth or fifth generation to farm a piece of land. How much does that weigh on a decision to sell or to rent? And, you know, somebody else is farming it, but you still have a hand on this land. You're still living on it.
Well, it's a very real emotion. My wife's family is on, I believe, their sixth generation on the same farmland. And, yes, it's something that the family always would like to see passed on to another generation. On the other hand, we don't want to see the situation where so much guilt is put on the remaining family members on the farm that they continue to operate just because they feel they have to, and not because they really enjoy the experience and are earning a meaningful living doing it. So it's a challenge. One of the things in terms of selling the property is a decision about what are you going to do if you were to sell the property for cash. How would you not only reinvest the cash, but also how would you treat that large capital gain for income tax purposes? And I think I would recommend anyone who's considering liquidating a farm asset to be sure you have competent income tax advice as well.
We'll leave it there for now. Arlen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
That was Arlen Brandstrom, Faculty Associate Emeritus from the UW Center for Dairy Profitability, with us to talk about the choice some farmers are facing as they get out of farming between renting or selling their farmland. You can read more about this topic, by the way, at wiscontext.org. If you think back to gym class and physical education in school, do you feel nostalgic or anxious? Turns out that feeling may affect the way you exercise or not as a grown-up. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think your past experience with gym class influenced your exercise habits to this day? Did you dread gym class or love it? Favorite part of the school day? Bad uniforms? Got hit in the face with a dodgeball? What's your worst gym class memory? Relive it. If you dare, call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Patty Ekakakis is a professor in the Department of Kinesiology at Iowa State University and specializes in exercise psychology. He was a lead researcher on a study that came out last month named My Best Memory is When I Was Done With It, all about how attitudes toward gym class affect our attitude toward exercise. Patty, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, you study this, you teach exercise and psychology. What made you want to look back and have other people look back at their gym classes in school?
Right. So the rates of physical activity participation in the United States are extremely low. Sometimes you may hear that 50% of Americans are essentially sedentary, but those figures are actually based on self-reports. When you objectively measure their activity, the percentage that actually satisfy the minimum recommended guidelines for physical activity are in the single digits. Some people say 2.5%, some people say 9%, but it's in the single digits. And when you ask them why are they sedentary, most people say lack of time, but there's no evidence that there is, in fact, lack of time when you look at the population overall. So most of the public health campaigns have been focusing on informing people about the benefits and trying to convince them on a very rational level that physical activity is good for them. But it turns out that almost everyone, 97% of American adults, recognize that being sedentary and not being physically active is a risk factor for chronic disease. So our focus was different. We focused on the emotional aspects of physical activity, and we started by looking at physical education as one potential problem area. So that was the motivation behind it. We wanted to see how people who are now adults remember their physical education experiences from 10, 20, 30 years ago and see whether those experiences had made an emotional impact on them.
And this is a key turning point. Kids, littler kids, they play, they get lots of activity that starts to slow down, if I'm reading this right, in those adolescent years. So gym class is that last-ditch effort to keep us moving around, right?
That is correct. There is a extensively documented dramatic decline in physical activity as kids transition from childhood to adolescence.
So you put this survey out there, a voluntary survey online, I believe. What kinds of things did you hear from people about their gym class memories?
So it is important to point out that the results were not overwhelmingly negative. You have people remembering physical activity or physical education very fondly, but most of those memories had to do with being athletic and therefore being congratulated or, by the coach or being recognized by the peers as somebody who is exceptionally gifted or talented or competent in sports. But obviously, our interest was mostly on the negative experiences. And when you look at the negative experiences, then you see perhaps what most people would guess, and that is experiences of embarrassment, experiences of being singled out and criticized for their body type, experiences of bullying, and so forth. And it turns out that the degree of remembered enjoyment of physical education continues to be associated with the amount that adults today spend being sedentary.
And that's the real key finding, it sounds like. If I hated gym class, if I felt embarrassed by it, I'm less likely to think of exercise as something I'm going to do. If I love gym class, I'm more likely, if according to this research, I'm more likely to keep exercising in the long run.
That is correct. But that said, it is important to also emphasize that that relationship is not extremely strong and is not deterministic. It means that if you had happened to have negative experiences, it will not automatically turn you into a sedentary adult. However, what happens is that a lot of adults spend years trying to find the type of physical activity that they enjoy, trying to overcome those early negative experiences. The typical example is that people who had negative memories from physical education were turned off to any social form of physical activity. So the presence of others or the potential of being evaluated negatively or criticized was still very much alive in their adult years. But once they discovered, for example, solitary forms of physical activity or exercise, then they were able to overcome those negative memories. So a lot of people say, you know, once I found walking by myself, that changed everything.
Talking to Patty Ekakakis from Iowa State University, talking about research on how we felt about gym class in school and how much we exercise as grown-ups. Go to your calls now. Carol is with us in West Bend. Carol, hi.
Hi. Excuse me.
What do you want to tell us about, Carol?
Well, I'm 79 years old, and I went to gym in Milwaukee at Benjamin Franklin Graded Elementary School for many years. I never liked it, and I have tell people now I have spent most of my life avoiding exercise. And part of it is I don't think the teachers in my day, the gym teachers in my day were not terrific. Mm-hmm. You know, they were not very especially good at getting people to enjoy this what we were doing.
Carol, thanks a lot for the call. Patty, are there lessons here for gym teachers or people who make policy about how gym class should happen about encouraging not just the natural athletes, everybody, to have a good time?
Yeah, you know, the concerns about physical education are raised periodically from time to time, and they trigger, I think, a natural defensiveness on the part of physical education teachers who feel that they're overworked, they're underpaid, they don't have the resources they need. The message that we want to communicate is that we have the know-how today by making small changes to the way that we do things in physical education to make the experience better. It doesn't take additional equipment. It doesn't take, large investments of money or time. It takes perhaps little careful strategic changes in the way that we do things, and we can make the experience more enjoyable, more pleasant than it is today.
Thanks for that call, Carol. We'll go to Anna in Richland Center. Anna, hi.
Hi. I had just a couple of short anecdotes. When I was in grade school, I think we were doing sprints or something, and I collided head-on with another classmate, and I got a huge, ghastly-looking black eye. And then when my sister was in high school, I think they were playing dodgeball or something like that, and a classmate caused her to break her arm, part of her forearm. She's an oboist. So she was in a cast for a while and missed out on honors orchestra and other things like that. So that was pretty unpleasant.
Anna, thanks for sharing that. Patty, was that a common memory, the gym-related injury that you heard from people?
Yes, it was. It was one of the categories of negative memories, both experiencing an injury yourself and witnessing an injury that happened to somebody else. It's important to point out that some of those experiences can very well be severe or traumatic, and they're very hard to overcome in later years. So perhaps that was consistent with the story that we just heard. Once you experience something like that, it's kind of hard to get over it.
Just a half a minute left, Patty. Hit us with one little change that could make gym class more effective.
So the main factor is try to eliminate the traditional emphasis on competition and social comparisons, because those, I think, are the primary source of traumatic or negative memories from physical education.
We'll leave it there. Patty, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking to Patty Ekakakis, a professor in the Department of Kinesiology at Iowa State University, specializing in exercise psychology. He was senior author on a study that focused on attitudes toward gym class in school and how those experiences and memories, as we've been hearing, can influence our feelings toward physical activity as adults and affect how much exercise we get and don't get as adults. You can still share your gym memories, good or otherwise. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, and let us know how it affected your exercise career. It's a special time of year. The new nominees are out for the National Toy Hall of Fame in Rochester, New York. A lot of the most famous toys have already been inducted, but there are 12 finalists now for this year's class. Here are some of the toys, games, and activities on the new list of nominees, along with my editorial comments. American Girl Dolls, a classic Wisconsin connection, should be in. Chalk, what kid doesn't love chalking on the sidewalk and rain cleans it up? Beautiful, it's in. Chutes and Ladders, no way. Terrible game, it can theoretically go on forever if you keep hitting those slides. Bad, keep it out. Magic 8 Ball, Reply Hazy, ask again later. Fisher Price Corn Popper, great for little kids. I'd play with it right now, it's in. Masters of the Universe, Ookla Aerial Ride, I think that's Masters of the Universe. Pinball, yes, a natural. Sled, yeah, who doesn't love a sled? Grown-ups, too painful. Tic-tac-toe, out, pointless. There's no way to win once both people know what they're doing. Don't induct it. Tickle Me Elmo, you know, after my generation, but sure, why not? Tudor Electric Football, where the guys move around randomly. It's a good lesson in frustration with life. I say it's in. Finally, the game Uno. I could go either way on that one. A lot of people play it. There are better card games out there. Those are the nominees for the National Toy Hall of Fame. We'll be watching for the finalists and maybe talk to the curator. He's a lot of fun. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.